Hello and welcome back to Horse Friends. Today I'm meeting Lynn Pantery, and Lynn is a masterclass student of mine. But what we are talking today about is not what we are doing together in the masterclass. Now we are kind of cooperating there too, but what her profession is. And she is, among other things, she is a movement intelligence instructor. And I have been working with her myself a little bit for, you know, you can never have too much C training. And it makes a huge difference in my movement. And I don't want to hold back that kind of knowledge from you. So we will talk a little bit about what she is working with, but also about her career as a professional dancer before she got professional with horses. And I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to the podcast, Lynn. Nice having you here.
Well, thank you for having me, Selena. This is an honor.
It's an honor to have you here. And we have met each other through Academic Art of Riding, of course, like I'm meeting most people. But today we will not talk, or a little bit, we will also talk about Academic Art of Riding, but mainly we will talk about what you are doing as a profession next to riding horses. You have a very particular profession. And we always have so fantastic conversations about that. So I thought, let's just get that online somehow, because most people will profit from that. Tell us a little bit about you and about your journey, that we can get a feel for it.
Well, my background has always been in movement. I used to dance professionally in my very first life back in the 70s and 80s, or in the 80s, I danced professionally. And the reason I bring that up here is because I've had, of course, gone through a whole career through corporate America and and now as I come around in my life, I'm coming back to movement and teaching movement again in a different way. But I mention this because, dance, yes, being is a form of self-expression. But I realized, had I had a lot of these, I'll call them tools, or had this, some of this wisdom of doing movement intelligence, which is the somatic work I teach now, boy, I probably could have had a lot less injuries and even performed better for that matter, right? So because as dancers, I think you're strong, and you're young and you can power through things. And, for instance, I used to recognize that my right pirouette was different than my left pirouette, but mm-hmm. I really never had any ways to help to make it better without trying to power through it. So those are the kinds of things that I think could have really helped. Mm-hmm. And I think certain injuries, you come to accept that, I'm just going to be in pain. I'm sore all the time. I was always, and you accept that as normal, and it doesn't have to be normal.
I had a conversation with Mary lately, with Mary Bono, and she said one of the things that were really striking me in that conversation was that when she turned 20, she started to feel pain everywhere in her body. And then she thought, this is normal. I'm just getting old. And it's just, I am 40 now. You're a little bit older than me. And I don't have pain in my body. Neither have you. Okay, you got an injury, but usually you don't have pain in your body. But I think we can't repeat that often enough. Pain is not normal. And
right.
we can do something against that, right?
Yeah, there's things we can do to help ourselves. And my thing here is, in talking about an injury, I recently, as you well know, broke my foot 8 months ago from falling off of a ladder, and it was a pretty traumatic fall. But the thing is, if I didn't have this work of Bones for Life or movement intelligence or the Feldenkrais work, I would have been, I think, a lot worse off. But because I already had this tool set, I call it a tool set, because I had this knowledge and this, I was able to use that biological optimism, right, to find what can I do? Okay, I have to wait for the foot to heal. Obviously, it's got to heal. But does that mean that I have to let all these other patterns just set in? And you have to accept it to a point, right? You're limping around there's still what else can I do to keep myself moving and to help my healing process and keep myself so that I can heal, I think, faster, or at least, doesn't, to help myself through the process. Because don't get me wrong, there's days where I would get frustrated about it, but I'd always be able to find things that I could do, and I always found things I could do on the floor or sitting in chairs. There's so many options, and you find these different options, and I think that's what kept me going through it and still is keeping me going through it.
Cool. So what was their first, when we are going a little bit back on the timeline, what was their first, dancing or riding?
Horses have, just since I was can remember, they've just always been a passion for me. My poor parents, I mean, I did not grow up in the country, but I used to bug them all the time. And I would spend any moment, I mean, all I really, anything I could get my hands on about horses or be around horses, even, it wasn't just about riding for me. I just loved being with the horses. And so my sister always reminds me of the very first day when I discovered this horse. We had moved, I'm from the Detroit area in Michigan, and we'd moved to the suburbs and there was still some farmland around there. And I discovered this horse, you know, in a distant lot. And I was probably about 5 years old. And I remember just, I'd go out there and just sit out there with this horse. And I just heard, this is in the, and a little black, I don't, you know, anyway, just sat out there for hours. And my mom would say, boy, I always know where I can find Lynn when I don't know where she is. And so one day my sister would come out and her friends would come out. We'd visit the horse. But then the owner came out to bring the horse in to the barn at eating time. And she said, do you, and I'd never met the owner before, you know, I mean, you're a kid, you just kind of do things, right? And she says, and she goes, do you want to ride him? And I go, yeah. So she puts me, I mean, I remember I'm wearing this little white culotte outfit. You know, I still remember what I was wearing. And she says, and so she just puts me on his back and walked me back to the barn. And my sister says, when she put you on that horse, your face lit up. And that was it for me. You know, that was the end of it. So that was, I mean, it's a very vivid memory for me. And that was like where it all started. So then, of course, so that's where it started with horses. So they've always been in my life. But I had to, you know, I would barter and do anything I could. I cleaned, helped people with chores and did everything I could so that I could
be
around the horses. Yeah.
Yeah. That was the same for me. That was the same for me. Yeah. So my parents basically couldn't afford. Also, there were different periods. And at the start, it was like that in Germany at that time, you were not allowed to start riding before you were 10.
Hmm.
10 or better, 12, just to be also, you know, tall enough for sitting on a big pony or proper horse.
Uh-huh.
So it was recommended to do voltage before, or voltige. Do you say voltige or voltage in English?
Volte? I'm not sure. Volte,
you know, when you're going up on the horse and doing gymnastics.
Okay, then I think they call that volte. But anyway,
Volte. Yeah, we are calling it volte. Yeah. Voltige. Okay. Yeah. Mm, so.
Wow, you have to do that before you can sit on the horse.
Yeah, yeah. Mm, yeah, but there was no opportunity in my surroundings, so that was awful. And then I was sometimes allowed during weekends to go to one of these farms where you can borrow a horse for half an hour and drag it through the forest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Horrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
God, horrible. But it was difficult for me to wait. And then I was training voltige on our sofa. I will never forget that. That was a very big thing for me as a child, to train regularly on our sofa. If I haven't had a horse, I could do at least the postures on a sofa. Was something. And I started when I was 9. So
We used to, we used to play horses when we were kids too, right? Mm-hmm. And so we'd canter, you know, pretend we were cantering and trotting. So you do that stuff naturally when you're a kid, when you really love it anyway, you know?
Yeah, so. Absolutely. And then when did you start dancing?
Pretty young also. Well, not as young as some people start, but I think I was around, maybe 8 mm-hmm. years old or something like that. So some people start really young. I was a little bit older.
I think I that dancing. Is still pretty young.
Yeah. And then, of course, there were times I was in and out. There were boys that got involved in that. And I was always pretty athletic. I mean, I liked to do a lot of different things, too. And then I got more serious about it as a teenager. And I started actually taking ballroom dancing when I was 17. Also, and so, you know, tap and ballet were my big thing. I was never great at tap. I taught tap later on, but to kids, but I was never like, wasn't my strong point. But and so I was, but that's the other thing with ballroom dancing, right? Is so much about that. There's a lot we can learn from that. Mm-hmm. You know, we taught a lot of the Latin dances, but also the foxtrot and the tangles and the waltzes. But you have to have this. There's a give and take that goes on. And yeah, you're being presented by the man, but there's also following and a leading that's happening too, right? And there are some, I remember there were certain people that I did not want to, you know, as a teacher, you have to teach all the certain ones, like stepped on your toe all the time. But anyway, some people would just whip you around like you didn't matter. And you think about that from a horse's perspective even, right? So it does help to give you perspective of how, what's this partnership with our horse? How am I as a dance partner? You know, and so I really try to keep that in mind also, take that training of from the ballroom dancing. And even when you're dancing in groups, I was in dance companies, and you have to always be aware of your surroundings, right? You know,
absolutely.
You know, you're training in front of a mirror a lot. And then when you switch and you got to turn away when you're getting ready for a performance, you turn away from the mirror and it's a whole different perspective. And so you have to be paying attention to where everybody is and not banging into people. And, you know, so you learn a lot about that. I think there's such a relationship between dancing, doing those kinds of things, and
this kind of
working
dancing
with horses.
I also think, you know, I have done ballroom dance just for 8 years, but just on a hobby level, but I really liked it. And
oh yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, super fun. And I also,
as long as you don't do it with your husband, I don't know, but I'm just kidding.
My husband is not so keen on it.
Yeah, it's usually with the teaching couples, they were fighting most of the time. You know, they were like, we're here to save our marriage. And it's like, I don't think this is helping your marriage. They didn't want to dance with each other. Not always, but most of the time.
Interesting.
Anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to throw that in.
No,
you were saying.
I actually think that my husband is a very good dancer. He's just not so keen on going to dancing classes. So
Yeah,
we have actually been doing that when we were still traveling in between Norway and Germany. But here in Norway, we have stopped also because we are lacking a good teacher here, because he's pretty talented. He doesn't have my experience, but he's quite good in touching and finding the movement. When he's finding it, then it's there. But I think it is also so, you know, the different ballroom dances, it's also a great way of training movement patterns.
Absolutely.
And that is something that we can really also use when we are later on working with horses, because we have an ear and we have an eye for different beats, for different rhythms, for finding extension and collection, and so on and so on. And sometimes I also think it's quite good to put yourself into beginner shoes again. I remember that when I started, you know, I had just all these years of experience with ballroom classes. So I thought, okay, I can dance. And then I went to Gotland and lived there with Hannah for some years. And then we had a fantastic salsa teacher there. He's very funny because he's from Cuba. So he was, he is Lazaro. He is a real Cuban thing. And also very, very not pedagogic. So it was like eat it or die, kind of just putting you somewhere there, and he was doing his thing and you were trying to stumble over your feet.
Yeah.
But it was a completely different set of movement than what I was used to from before. And was very, just this experience, I don't like to be a beginner, but just this experience of starting to integrate and to learn a new movement pattern. That was so rich.
Yes. Yeah. Different, very different. That's, you know, you're reminding me, there's this video. It's on YouTube, and maybe we can mark this down for people, but it's called, I think it's called When the Moment Sings. It was, I don't remember if who did this? They did this documentary YouTube thing, and it's really talking about the difference between the West, our industrialized culture, and our Western culture, and African culture, for instance, and how so much of their life, not saying it's an easy life, but their life is based on rhythm. Everything they do is rhythm. And this is where this whole water carrier walk comes in, that that the movement intelligence work is based on too. So I'll maybe after this, I can tend to, there's a YouTube link, When the Moment Sings, and it's about a half hour documentary, and you can see the beauty and how they start the young kids and carrying these water, heavy loads on their head. But anyway, rhythm and this coordination that we lose from, you know, in our society, you know, sitting in chairs all the time, driving in cars and being stagnant. I mean, who made up sitting in chairs anyway? It's an interesting thing.
It's a very interesting question, right?
You know, because other cultures that, you know, they squat, you know, they're doing their work, they're squatting all the time. And we try to go to yoga and squat and like, ow, you know, if you're not, you know, haven't been doing that for some time, right? Or, you know, so for them, these things are a little more, you know, normal. And yet we're trying to incorporate this into our culture. So I think we have some different, I think yoga, you know, is meant, you know, they can do those things easier than we can. And we have to, I think, understand that for ourselves too.
It's also very interesting when I'm looking at my 3-year-old now, or she is turning 3 now, because she is squatting when she's doing something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When she's exploring things, she's squatting and then
exactly
playing with a book or building towers or something. So the sit down, you really have to train.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it kind of makes sense. I guess it was a practical thing, I suppose, but we do lose that ability.
It appears to be very natural for our body. It appears to be
yes. Yeah.
Deep down movement pattern also makes sense, right? Because it straightens the spine. It's putting your hip into a good position. So no hollow back, no nothing. It's giving a release on the neck. So why not?
And what's interesting about too, you probably look at her and sometimes you might say, oh, she's slouching, you know, and, you know, I mean, you know, kids, they're just doing whatever. And I think that's the point too, is that we have options. We don't have to be in this perfect upright position. We shouldn't be expected to be in this perfect upright position. But, you know, the world is full of asymmetries. We're asymmetrical. Mm-hmm. Our bodies, I mean, even our organs are in, you know, different places in our mm-hmm. bodies. And so to have an expectation of having this posture all the time. And that's why I'm always careful about using the word posture. It's one of mm-hmm. those words that can have different meanings for people, but it's really about you can still have some scoliosis or whatever and differences, but we can still move efficiently and optimally. And we work with the body that we have or patterns that have developed over time, whether it be from injuries or, and like you say, babies don't have all this. And so probably after they're 3, they start developing certain patterns too, right?
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, I think sitting in classrooms, you know, I had so much trouble sitting. It wasn't because I didn't like to learn, but boy, I had trouble sitting still in class. I remember I was a heebie-jeebie kid, right? And so that's another thing I hope would change soon is, you know, like I have one of these chairs that, it allows me to move. This is great for riders, by the way. Mm-hmm. And I think that they need more of these to be this kind of thing for kids in school, because they shouldn't be expected to sit perfectly still all the time. And maybe that's changing. I don't know.
Or maybe we just need to teach the pedagogical concept of, you know, sitting still in general. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But how necessary is it? You know, is it natural, right?
No. Yeah.
And so we want to move. We're meant to move. So
I agree. But you have been mentioning the word movement intelligence now several times. And now I'm getting curious. So what exactly is movement intelligence? And then you have been talking about that it is based on this, how do you call it? Water cooler talk?
The water carrier.
Water
carriers. Yeah. That was one of the things. So Ruthie Alon created it's a body of work of movement intelligence. Ruthie Alon, I'll tell you who, she actually just died a couple years ago.
Can you repeat the name again?
Ruthie Alon.
Okay.
And she created the movement intelligence work starting with Bones for Life. And then there's other programs in their Walk for Life, mindful eating, solutions for optimal mobility. And so anyway, this whole movement intelligence is a body of work. And I think Bones for Life might have been her first one that she expanded from. She was one of Moshe Feldenkrais's first, I think, 13 trainers, right?
I see.
And so she was a Feldenkrais trainer for many years. And she then, as she got into her 60s, you know, she started to see herself in pictures and noticed her own posture changing. And she's like, wait a minute, you know, I'm supposed to be this, you know, she could move and very flexible mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Very coordinated. But then she's like, what's going on? And so then she got interested in the whole idea of how people were falling from hip fractures, from osteoporosis, right? She started mm-hmm. to dive deeper into this. And then also, so this is what then helped, you know, got her moving into this whole idea and then exploring the water carriers. How are they carrying these loads, right? Because there was like this research that was done, I want to say about 30 years ago. And basically that, not to say that they didn't get osteoporosis and not to say that their lives were easy, but they didn't have these hip fractures that they did. So, you know, So what, but the idea with it was that to build, how can we build this coordination and balance? And then also at the same time, build some, build bone strength too.
Wow.
But I'm not going to sit here and say that, oh, you're going to be cured of osteoporosis. But when we're feeding, you know, we do these vibrations in the right amount, not hard impact, but these certain vibrations, just like even in walking, right? Efficient walking. Then we're nourishing our bones. We're getting the blood flow. And so that's really what it's about, from bottom up and then top down. And so a lot of this has to do with, the work is based on this domino effect, right? This, the curves. And so if you think about, if you have one of those dominoes, right? If you do the game of dominoes, right?
Right? We all know that from our childhood, right? Yeah.
Right. But if you take one of those out, you know, now you could be putting a lot of, you're going to stop the flow of, say, energy or this transmission through the whole spine. And then you're over, you could be overdoing it in that area where it's stuck, maybe the C7, or maybe you, if you see some people, maybe they tend to walk with an overarched curve, you know, a big in curve. And then you're, you know, you're putting 1.5 times your weight on, you know, your impact on that stepping. That's a lot to put on an area that's not meant to take that much pressure.
Yeah.
So just like with our horses, right? And that's why this, to me, resonates so well with, thank goodness, you know, with the academic art of riding. These two things just go together. And I love work. That's why I love working with you, Selena, because we incorporate these things. And it's just all these concepts, these principles apply of this whole, the different dimensions of movement, right? It's, we have the wave and the axis and the rotations happening. And we do the same. We're not so different. Right.
No, not at all. I mean, in riding or in classical dressage, it's called straightness, right?
Yeah.
It's a principle of straightening up, or the deeper meaning of straightening up. And then I'm experiencing that the we have that problem in a lot of terms in writing, also due to the translation problem. In German, we have just so many more words for writing stuff.
Yes.
Than in other languages. So for example, this flexion of the pole is something that is each time making my toenails roll up, that I'm feeling a little bit when I'm hearing that, because it's not a flexion of the pole that you're searching for. And the German word for that is Stellung. So, and Stellung incorporates the idea of having neck, chest bone, and sacrum in one line. And then it's also, you know, it doesn't have to happen in the head first. It can come from behind and happens first in the hip, or the first thing you're aligning is the chest bone, and then the head and the hip comes naturally, or you do the head, or the head is looking in one direction and then the rest of the body comes aligns naturally. That's why I also, I very much like to talk about alignment instead of straightness.
Yes. Because
the word straightness has such a, And that is exactly your topic, or where we are ending up again and again, where you're saying, okay, the communication is difficult, right?
Yes, yes. And that's why I picked as the topic. I mean, body language is, of course, the language of the horse, and it, but it's so important for us as humans too, right? But this word posture even, or, you know, can be so misinterpreted depending on your experiences with it, your how you're raised, even your generation, like people who are maybe from certain generations might think of posture as a certain rigidity. Or when you say, okay, what is good posture for you? And some people be like, oh, standing straight, right? But how, you know, practical is this for movement? You know, yeah, okay. Yeah, it's good to learn to feel what this might be. But then now, you know, how can I take this into movement when I need it? And that's really what it's about. And I think, so that's why, yeah, it can have different meanings for different people. Some people think of when they have good posture, they say, oh, I feel lighter. I feel more equal. I feel more balanced. So everybody has a different meaning for posture. So that's why I like to use, I say, you know, let's experience, let's let posture be a process versus this object. You know, it's not this thing this you just do. Yeah, this pose. It's not about a pose, right? That's, you know, that's not very practical. We're moving. So how can we move in the most optimal ways possible? So we do things that are very unusual to create, you know, we, of course, like the rib cage, Ruthie would call this is a tough nut to crack. And yeah, it's definitely important to to have a rib cage that's supporting, but we, you know, our rib cages can also become, so it affects our breathing, right? Mm-hmm. So we do start to get a little bit more of this movement to create a little bit more movement in the rib cage, but not, of course, it's not meant to move as much as say the neck or the low back. But when this is stiff, these other parts, we overwork them. And then we hear people, oh, my neck hurts or my low back hurts. You know, you start to have these other, because we're not letting that proportional distribution, that proportional flexibility, right? So to go through the whole spine. And that's really what we're talking about here, is depending on the task. So your posture really depends on the task. You know, if I'm getting up from a chair versus, you know, maybe I'm walking, or, you know, or we have a homolateral walk versus a contralateral. Well, sometimes there's a use for doing the same side thing. It just, it really has to do with the function that you're doing. And it's to have options and possibilities, right? That I can do it this way or that way. And then you practice it, and then you go out and you let your body do what it wants to do and let the spontaneous changes happen as they do.
So tell me a little bit. I had a few sessions with you, and I was really impressed what it was doing with the feeling and what it was doing with my movability. So how are you integrating that into your writing lessons? Or are you integrating it into the writing lessons, or are you training separately? Just,
I'm glad you bring that up. That's a, because I think that that's something, what I like about this. I mean, I practice different modalities. I mean, I've done Pilates and yoga, and they're all good things. I'm not saying anything bad about any of it. But what I personally, this is my own experience, lacked was the ability to say, how can I take this out off of the mat and into my life and into my work with my horses? So I find that movement intelligence, because it is all based on the same similarities of what we're doing in the academic work with the horses, it's like, God, we're not so different. And I started to make those correlations. So that was from a physical standpoint, I see a lot of connection there. And I learn a lot about working with the horses. Sometimes it actually helps me when we're doing something to learn about the horse's anatomy or in how we're doing it by doing it myself. And then I'm kind of like, oh, this is sort of the same thing, a little bit of the same thing I'm asking with my horse. And so it gives me this little deeper understanding. I know that we're a little different, but we're not that different.
Not that different, no.
And so I can also play with it that way. So that's one of the connections I make, right? And I'll go on all fours sometimes myself and say, if I'm standing this way, what might be happening here? You know, it's a little, you know, I'm not the horse, but those are some things I'll play with. But also, I think what I really like about it is the principles. And these are, you know, movement intelligence is based on Feldenkrais principles too.
Yes.
But we, there's the less is more, right? There's this guideline of 20% or less of effort when you're learning something, 20% or less. We don't go to the maximum. It's not about reaching some goal. It's not about ending the task. It's about working through the process. And yeah, maybe you're a little stuck somewhere and you're like, oh, wait, that's a little strange. And then it teaches you about yourself too. How do I deal with when I don't understand something? That's like, oh, that stupid teacher, he's not explaining it. No. Or, you know, or why can't I do this? You know, you start to learn about yourself and how you deal with things that aren't necessarily going as smoothly as you'd hope. But then you, when you pause, there's a lot going on. We do lots of pauses and rest in there. This is where the learning happens. And then you come back to it and you say, what if I try this? What if I try doing it with my foot? What if I try lifting it from here? So you start to, it creates, we do a lot of work asymmetrical actually, right? So we're doing these unique movements that are more novel, and it deprograms us. Yeah. And so it wakes us up to say, something's different here. And so it allows for creative problem solving, right? It allows us to solve problems, and it helps us learn how to solve problems. So we do that through movement. But I say how you walk is how you ride, but in a way, people don't necessarily, sometimes that goes, and also I do have a saying, you know, in teaching some experiential learning, sometimes I would say to people, how you do one thing is how you do everything, because it really is. It's, and I know, you know, at least most things, right? So I think we can practice those things in our body as a laboratory. And then I can take the same way I would teach a class or prepare myself to do a movement lesson. Yes. I can have that same mindset and take these concepts of slow, paying attention, and being aware of the small tries, you know, just this whole awareness, having the variation of movements, right? So all these different things, being flexible goals, all those strategies or all those things that are involved in it that you can learn in a movement lesson, you can take that into the lesson and working with your horses too. So not just from a physical standpoint, mm-hmm. but even how we can educate ourselves.
If I understand you correctly, if I want to work with you, I don't need a horse. I can do that at home on the floor, or I can do that on a chair or something. And then you're working with the movement patterns.
Yes.
And also, from what I'm hearing in between the lines, it's a lot for the brain, right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. The nervous system, for sure. Yes. We're opening up new pathways to learning when we start doing these on you. You know, we go into a strange pose here and say, okay, mm-hmm. now let's add some movement into that. But we're doing it. What's interesting about this and what I think makes it work is that it's more indirect changes. We're not saying you're going to fix this thing right here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. We do it kind of through the back door. And I think that's what makes it effective, right? Nobody wants to have a direct criticism, and, you know, the body doesn't, you know, you can over time repeat. And I suppose, but it's much easier to learn when something feels good to you.
Absolutely.
You'll want to do it.
You want to do it, right? You want to go back into this feeling of feeling good. And also with horses, I'm often talking about that we want them to have movement intelligence, movement competence. Sorry.
Right,
movement
right,
competence,
right.
That they are feeling competent in what they are doing and not pressed into a shape, but finding this like a flow naturally.
Yeah. Yeah. They probably already have movement intelligence, right?
If we don't disturb so much.
We're the ones that kind of, you know, mess that up for them, right?
Yeah. It's the same as with children, right?
Yes.
Yeah. As before we try to raise them properly to make good humans out of them that can sit on a table and stuff, then they are having a lot of movement intelligence. There is no problem.
I'm sorry.
I have one more for you, because I just had to think about lately watching my child play. I remember that we two had a few sessions where we were talking about how to get up from the floor and finding this, you know, she's just doing it.
Exactly. And I teach this spiraling, and, you know, I'm going to be doing it as a bonus gift. I'm going to put that in as one of the, I have these, it was really hard. I'm doing five top favorites of these of 5 to 15 minute sessions. So, you know, sometimes we don't have time for a whole hour, and maybe I feel, there's something I'd like to do for myself for the moment. I'm putting together these anywhere from 5 to 15 minute sessions, and spiraling to get up is going to be one I'm going to put in there. And it's really hard to pick my top five favorites, because as I'm putting this together, I'm like, oh, that's my new favorite. They all become my favorite as I do them. But anyway, I am going to be putting up getting up from a chair. There's so many ways we can do this, right? But I am going to do the spiraling from the floor to stand. Because you're right, absolutely. And when I teach this in class, I have a video of a child he just whips around, Exactly. And it's exactly the same thing if you slow it down. And that's what we're doing. So a lot of these movements are off. So they're based on these development patterns that we're doing. And we actually do a lot of things in creeping and crawling too, where there's definitely movements for that, for helping us to find our coordination in those movements where we're, you know, we use a wall. We can get on all fours and we'll take a movement. And so it's like walking is a process, but then we're breaking it down to these different components of movement.
And it's always saying that, you know, we have picked the horse as our animal because our movement is fitting so well together.
Yes, yes.
And when I'm looking at my child and all, then she has so many of these movements that I had to try to relearn, or I had to rediscover when I started doing academic out of riding, because it was not, you know, when you're doing ballroom dance, the movement is going up. You're standing on the toe and everything
much
goes
more.
Yes.
Yeah.
And when you're doing Cuban salsa, everything goes into the floor.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
And in academic art of riding, or if you want to sit not on top of a horse, but in a horse, it needs to go into the floor. You need the Cuban salsa movement and not the.
Right. Yeah.
You know, into the sky, getting stiff and moving straightened up. And for me, that was really a journey to find this letting go process. But also it's a mutual problem then, because if I am sitting on top of the horse and are very stiff, my horse can neither find the movement. So the first time you're going through it, it's very, very difficult because you have to educate your horse mm-hmm. to open the bag and move soft. And at the same time, you have to stay soft and discover your own movability. And that is what I like so much about your concept.
Well, you brought something. You see this amulet? This was originally, someone gave one of these to Ruthie. It was a real bone. This is not a real bone. But this is something we get when we, you know, become certified teachers, right? It's so interesting you're bringing this up. And I actually printed this out because I want to read. There's actually like a prayer or a mantra that goes behind this. Because we have these, well, two of the strategies of locomotion, right? We have axis and we have wave. Right. Okay. So we have axis and wave, and then of course these other dimensions of movement. But I'm talking about two right now. So axis, you're talking about axis, this longitudinal axis, mm-hmm. this uprightness, and I know on mm-hmm. the horse it's more mm-hmm. this way. But here's this prayer behind or a mantra behind this. It says, "Grant me the flexibility in each of my joints, so that I have freedom of movement, and give me the power to post one vertebrae on top of the other." So I will have a strong and reliable axis of spine and the wisdom to know the difference. Right? So it's dependent on what we're doing. And yeah, you have to have both, right? So mm-hmm. even if you're chain, you know, if you want, sometimes you want more axis, other times you want more movement. But yeah, that you have to have both in there. And it is the wisdom to know the difference. So I'm so glad you brought that up because it was so fitting to that.
Yeah, and also the ability to move without effort.
Yes, yes, right, because it's just, yes.
It has to be effortless.
Yes, it's not, sometimes we're teaching things and it's artificial and we want to go mm-hmm. from artificial to organic, right? And that's what we're trying to help ourselves find, to find what is organic to us or what, yeah. you know, what was and we lost it. And then it just, there is this biological optimism that you get when you have, you know, when you're doing the creeping thing and you start to get it, you're just like, you know, there's this primal thing that comes back to you when you start to feel all your parts really in harmony with each other. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of mm-hmm. come back to some like, wow, I was this creature, you know, anyway.
That sounds very interesting. Eventually, I will make you, I will ask you to do this creepy thing.
Okay. Yeah. We have it in a few phases. We do it. We really break it down.
Cool. That yeah. sounds very funny.
We have breaking down of the water carrier walk too. We have a few phases of that. We practice doing, we have a bones wrap and bones, we have a wrap and we use that as a crown and we use that to practice this. But we really do break this down in different movements, but we do practice with a crown too. So we use this wrap to support us. There's lots of different things we do. The idea is to make it create these greenhouse conditions for learning, to make it feel safe, to fill in with padding. There's, you know, we want to make it as comfortable for us to relearn, to learn as possible.
And that's an important thing that you're bringing up there because, you know, my favorite topic is stress since a few years because mm-hmm. I discovered how important not only for riding and performing, but also in our life, how important mm-hmm. that is for horses, for humans, how high the stress level actually is and how much it is changing if we can lower it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yes. And there you are going exactly in that direction, because when you're saying you're making it as comfortable as possible, then you are also working with the nervous system and working on coming into, not only coming into, you know, stress makes stupid. So not only coming into an area where you can learn, but also where you are training to let go.
Right, right. Yeah, we have to challenge it enough, but not so much that it's not in the too much, right? There's all that balance. Where do we challenge a little bit, but not so on. Yeah. A little uncomfortable maybe, but not so uncomfortable that it's painful or bringing back this trauma or whatever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I really like that. So I know that you have, Lynn is joining the summit, so she has prepared a really cool lecture and she has prepared some freebies, I think, for the audience that is joining in the bonus package. But for the podcast audience, or if you're meeting a new rider, let me ask like this, if you have a new student and if you can just give them one thing, one like really, really tiny or really quick thing that is making a big difference, what would that be?
I would say to start to trust yourself. Mm. And that takes practice, right? But mm-hmm. by doing this work, right, you be your own book of wisdom. And I have that. Yeah. Be your own book of wisdom. You know, you don't have to start to, you develop autonomy, right? And mm-hmm. I can't just tell somebody to do that, but that's what this is about, is to help you master autonomy. So be your own book of wisdom. You know, don't just, yeah, study is great, but then kind of go back and say, now what do I feel about that? And then that'll lead you into directions where you might need to dive in deeper, and then you can come back and experience it again. So it's not just about the cognition, right? If we want to get better at something, we still have to experience it too. And then we can, yeah, go ahead.
And that is exactly why it integrates so nicely also with academic art of writing, not only because we have the same idea about learning and how movement should be, but also because it's a big, big point in my teaching also that I want the students to find out what we are doing and then get independent of me. So
yes.
Yeah. And we also want the horses to understand, yes. And not, you know, if you need all your aids and all the aids that you're having and all the force that you are having for riding a shoulder in, there's nothing left for maybe trotting or for maybe collecting or mm-hmm. crazy things like taking your turn. So it's this idea of, yeah, competence that you are passing back to your student, right? If it
hopefully,
is a horse or
yeah.
a human. Yeah. Yeah, hopefully. You never know.
But there is, it is when I'm teaching and I have a group of equestrians I'm mm-hmm. teaching, and I just love it when we'll talk about mm-hmm. the process we've done, and they start to make these correlations. It's like music to my ears when they start to make these connections of how, wow, yeah, they related to something mm. with their horse. And I'm just like, thank goodness. Yes.
Yes.
Because that's, yeah. It's so important. It doesn't always happen naturally, but when I have that happening naturally for people or how they incorporate it into their life, I really love hearing that.
There's just one last question that I'm having for you, because are you only working with riders or are you also working with pain patients?
Again, yeah, either. I mean, either way.
Either way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, what's interesting. I mean, it's really not, again, you know, it's not so different. I mean, they mm-hmm. might come for a certain purpose, but overall it's not, the work is still the same.
It's interesting that you are saying that. Mm-hmm. I have just had an interview about the rider's seat and about the, you know, tool fitting to saddle and seat, and that a lot of riders are actually also experiencing pain while they are riding.
And yeah.
And then we can say it doesn't have to be like this.
Right. That's one of the things, like I have that, like it, if you're feeling pain, it's not normal. It doesn't have to be normal.
To be like,
don't
this.
Think you have to do it, because, you know, it just means that's your body talking to you. That's mm-hmm. your inner communication. We have to listen to that and say, hey, what's going on in here? Because why would you even want to do something that hurts anyway? So when we think about it, right? I mean, and I've been guilty of that too, right? Why do we?
Honestly, I'm asking this question very often, because usually I think that most of us have been started with riding because we like horses. Yeah. And then I'm seeing them sitting on a horse very stiff or being right. very, very focused and want to achieve the piaf or yeah. something. And then all this joy and this fun is getting lost. And that is so sad, because it
yes.
doesn't have to be like this.
Yes, I agree. You know, I've done that with, I remember this student I had, I said, here, pretend these are reins. And I could tell that like this, she went into this other zone, like you're saying, mm-hmm. another mode yeah. of, I'm like, wait a minute here, you know? So, but that's why I say how you walk is how you ride, you know?
Absolutely.
And she just totally went, even in her body. And I'm like, well, let's wait and get that a little more settled before you're sitting on one of my horses, because we want to keep things safe.
Yes. Anyway. Yeah, I'm also doing that regularly in clinics. I'm sometimes seeing people there like getting really tense, and then lately on a course I have been asking someone if they actually like horses, because she doesn't
yeah.
you know, if she's just aware of the fact, does she like horses? She doesn't have to be here. I mean, she's doing that because she wants to, right? And she was totally, I got her cold and she started crying and was just like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
I obviously I nailed it. And we had a very a very cool lesson afterwards and a very cool course afterwards. And then she took me to the side and said, you know what? That was exactly what I needed. I do like horses. This is not a competition here.
Right. And I think that's what happens. We get geared into this. I mean, that happened, you know, you're in a different world. I came up in this dressage world and it was just like, it wasn't working for me, but I always thought it was me, you know, and that, and I'm like, what am I missing here? I just, you know, but then I realized it's like, I'm, you know, they're the ones missing out on all the joy of this. And, you know, you go back to why is it that I want to be with horses? And then it just opens up, like you say, it opens up the doors to improve. Then you can improve. Otherwise, you're just stuck. Because again, you're meeting some standard that doesn't necessarily fit you, you know?
Ah, absolutely. And Lynn, you're in the US, right? Where exactly are you actually?
I'm in Maryland. I'm near DC, about a half hour from Washington, DC. So I'm in a town called Bowie, Maryland, near Baltimore, Annapolis, and DC.
But if somebody from Germany or Austria would like to work with you now, how can they do that?
We can definitely work online for sure. So that's the option.
That is no problem. So you are offering private lessons and maybe also an online course. Do you have a course or something?
Like right now, I'm actually doing a Revive Your Stride Light because there's so many processes we can do, right? So, this is a course specifically for equestrians. But then throughout, also, I do other series, I have a weekly like movement solutions class where we can work on certain themes. There's themes of the feet, themes of the shoulders and neck, themes for the pelvis, themes in squatting. Themes. So we have all these different themes for the low back, you know, but what's interesting, there's these themes but you still end up working, you know, it still is about integrating through the whole body. But one of the things that Ruthie, I think, wanted to do was create shorter processes so that they're more portable. And so what I'm trying to do is give people things that, hey, you don't have to learn it. Yeah. Take the time to learn it, but then you can take this and take 15 minutes or 5 minutes out of your day and bounce on heels or, you know, and do something short. And that was really, I think, where she was going with a lot of this work.
That was what you have been doing. It was me also. Yeah. I remember this bouncing. And I'm doing that often when I'm standing on the coffee machine, you know, or when I'm waiting for a horse just finishing its food or waiting for my pony to wake up after a massage or something. I'm often standing there.
Yeah, bouncing on heels. And that's the bread. That's Ruthie's bread. That's the bread and butter movement. It is the basic movement. And then we start working from there and we incorporate it into, but it's creating those soft vibrations. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. So.
Interesting. That was very interesting. And I have a lot more questions for you, but that will be for another day. Okay. And then I'm saying I will see you on the conference, on the summit. Not allowed to say conference anymore, not modern enough. my interns are putting me into place. It's important. They are right. There we will learn more about your work. And for tonight, I am saying thank you. We will link you in the show notes and link your website. And your website is?
IanaHorse.com.
IanaHorse.com. Exactly.
I know the spelling is not a little easier, so I guess they'll have to see it, but Iana, A-I-Y-A-N-A, horse.com. Iana, it means blossom eternal. That's why I picked that one of the meetings. Like, so I like that it's like always learning, always growing. So that's for the name Iana. It was a popular name actually for some time, but I liked it because of its meaning.
Very, very nice. And I'm saying thank you for today.
You're and welcome. Thank you.
See you. I'm seeing you online on the summit. And to everybody out there, really go and check out Lynn's webpage. It's really worth working with her. It will improve your seat immediately, even without sitting on a horse. So enjoy the journey. Have a nice evening. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.